everybody. Pleasure to have you here. I'm Sarah Stein. I'm a professor in the History Department, a member of the Center for Jewish Studies faculty, and very pleased to be the Sadie and Ludwig Kahn Director of the Levy Center for Jewish Studies. And it's my pleasure to welcome you here today. It's really our honor to be hosting this lecture today, the title of which is A Place in the Sun, Italian Jews and the Colonization of Africa, which is our first Viterbi seminar in Mediterranean Jewish Studies, which will be delivered by Professor Shira Klein of Chapman University. We, first of all, should apologize for the venue change, and thank you for your flexibility. Today's lecture is co-sponsored by a number of units, but I would be remiss if my first introduction and words of thanks did not go to Andrew Viterbi, who we thank for his ongoing, steadfast commitment, not just to UCLA, not just to Jewish studies, but to education in California and beyond. Thank you for joining us and for your support. Our next Viterbi lecture is also this week. It is given by Professor Andrew Burns, who returns to us since he was earlier a Viterbi Visiting Fellow. And he will be lecturing tomorrow at 4 p.m., he might be here, or perhaps not yet, on the title, The Foundation of the World, The Ecological Ideas of Post-Expulsion Spanish Jews in Italy and the Ottoman Empire. Now, Andrew Viterbi and the Viterbi Family Program in Mediterranean Jewish Studies has sponsored through our center for many years visitors coming as fellows for a year or sometimes a shorter amount of time, a series of programs and workshops and events that have really deeply enriched our appreciation, our understanding of the cultural, historical complexities of not only Italian Jewry, which is the particular history that the Viterbi family is rooted in, but also Mediterranean Jewry more generally. I want to, before I turn to introducing our guests, to thank the center's staff, as always, for their amazing grace and professionalism and efficiency. And I want to also ask you to just turn your, whatever you have that's noisy, a phone or anything else, take a moment to turn it to a silent mode. Now, we welcome today Shira Klein, an assistant professor of history at Chapman University. Professor Klein is the author of a recently published book by Cambridge University, a 2018 book, entitled Italy's Jews from Emancipation to Fascism. She has won awards from the Memorial Foundation for Jewish Culture, from the USC Shoah Foundation, the Yad Hanadiv Foundation, and the Barbieri Foundation. Her book, which I highly recommend to you, not only offers a sweeping history of the Jews in Italy, told through the lens of cultural history, political and legal history, and social history, but goes far in challenging what has been a prevailing assumption of scholarship on Italian Jewry, which is to say that after the emancipation of the Jews in Italy in 1848, there was a kind of reduction in the effervescence of Italian and Jewish cultural specificity. And her book goes very far in alerting us to the nuances, the diversity, the vivacious expression of Jewish cultural forms in Italy beyond the year of emancipation and through the years of Italian fascism. So we want to congratulate Dr. Klein on the publication of her book, and I hope you'll join me in offering her a warm welcome to UCLA. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Stein. I want to thank the Levy Center. It's such an honor to be here, and also to thank the Viterbi family. It's such an honor to meet Andrew Viterbi here today. My topic today is colonialism, and it's sort of fitting that I'm coming from Chapman University to UCLA, because often at Chapman we call UCLA the Empire. So here I am, the colonial subject, venturing in beyond the borders. Today I'll do two things. I will speak about how and why Italian Jews participated in Italy's African Empire. And then I'll examine the dynamics that developed between Italian Jews and the Jews in the African colonies. I'll just say that this is the start of a new book. It's still very raw in that sense, and it's an innovative field for me. I come from the field of European Jewish history, and as Professor Stein said, my book was a history of Italian Jews in the modern period, but sort of limited to the peninsula, where I look a little bit about migration to Palestine, migration to the US of refugees, but certainly focusing on the peninsula. So venturing to the empire is new for me, and in that sense, I would even say it's a new field full stop, because there isn't too much research, too much literature on this. So which is all to say that I very much will welcome your questions at the end. I'm sure that will stimulate new directions in my research. So let me begin with some background. The Italian Empire began in the 1890s when Italy took over parts of Somalia and parts of and Eritrea. So these are sort of darker areas over here, Somalia and Eritrea. Then it expanded in 1911 when Italy took over Libya and the Dodecanese Islands, which are sort of north of Egypt over there. And finally, the final stage was in 1935. And it was led by Benito Mussolini, who had come to power a few years before that in 1922 at the head of a fascist dictatorship. And Mussolini led the conquest of Ethiopia. Setting up Italian East Africa. And so he connected it with Eritrea and Somalia, which were already Italian, and set up Italian East Africa. And the empire lasted until World War II and formally dissolved just after. Italy was long thought to have been a benign kind of colonizer, a colonizer with a kind heart, who wanted the very best for their peoples, and whose colonial subjects welcomed it because of that reason. And Italy certainly marketed colonialism that way, particularly under fascism. And if you take a look at this image over here on the left, this is the cover page of a magazine that came out in Italy at the time of the Ethiopian conquest. And you can see over here to the left, these two black men who are raising their hand in fascist salute in honor of the Italian occupiers. So again, this image that Africans welcomed Italy to their region. And the same idea in this picture over here on the right. It's a carefully composed picture. It's propaganda. It shows these three men supposedly breaking out into a spontaneous salute at the site of Benito Mussolini on this huge poster. And so again, the idea of Africans welcoming Italy because it was such a benign colonizer. And I would say that this image even continues today, if not in the scholarship, but in a sort of a public opinion or in the public eye. But in fact, historians have shown that Italian rule was just as brutal as any other colonial regime. Italy's rule over Africa claimed over 100,000 lives. Italy used poison gas, which was by then an internationally banned weapon. They subjected Africans to forced marches, detention, concentration camps, daily racial discrimination, sexual exploitation, and so on and so forth. And these brutalities were accompanied by a massive propaganda campaign, a racist propaganda campaign, to show Italians as inferior. And here's one example. It appeared again at the time of the Ethiopian campaign, in, disturbingly enough, in a children's magazine. What you see over here is these two European children, two Italian, white Italian children, who are going exploring in Africa, only to be captured by these sort of barbaric, evil Africans. And the second panel, one of them is tied to a rod, while the other one is roasted and eaten, so they're cannibals in addition to everything. And the only way that the little boy is saved, the one who hasn't been eaten yet, is because these cannibals are just so stupid that they didn't realize the indigestion that would occur as a result of eating the first little boy. So showing them as evil, at the same time stupid and primitive and barbaric and cannibalistic. Now, despite Italy's extreme racism towards Africans, Italian Jews strongly supported their country's colonizing enterprise. And when I say Italian Jews, I mean the majority of Italian Jews. Italian Jewish support for colonialism began with Italy's very first forays into Africa. In the early 1890s, shortly after Italy had begun colonizing Eritrea, a Jewish man became counselor for agriculture in the new colony of Eritrea. This was just about the highest position that one could have in the colony. He was the mastermind behind planning how Italians would colonize Eritrea. So this was Leopoldo Franchetti. He was a member of Italy's Chamber of Deputies, and he was very well suited to the job. And as you can imagine, he was chosen carefully. He was an ardent admirer of colonialism. And the Jewish press was very supportive of him, and they were so proud, Jews were so proud to have one of their own in this high position in the empire, and so they were full of praise for his work. Then Jewish support resurged again in 1911, when Italy fought against the Ottoman Empire and ended up capturing Libya, and particularly the regions of Tripolitania over here, and Cyrenaica. And you can also see that it's slightly more colorful in that map on the right over there. And again, Jews were supportive of this conquest. We have one rabbi in Livorno who composed, and I quote, a special prayer imploring God for victory of the Italian armies deployed in Tripolitania. And this prayer was recited every Saturday. So imagine you would go to the synagogue, you'd pray for the Torah, and then everybody would get up and recite this prayer together after the reading of the Torah. Some Italian Jews joined up to fight. Some Italian Jews joined up to fight as soldiers in the invading armies. Here are the soldiers arriving in Libya, and there were Jews among them. Other Jews who couldn't fight, or Jewish women who were excluded from the army, they found other ways to support. So some of them would give money to fund the war in Libya. And the Jewish press again proudly would report such and such gave this and that amount. They would say exactly who gave how much, and take pride in the fact that Italian Jews were bolstering the war effort. And the final stage of Italian colonialism, which I said before was the conquest of Ethiopia in 35-36, it whipped up the most enthusiasm, both from Jewish and from non-Jewish Italians. And I put this map over here because it gives us an inkling of why Italians were so supportive of empire. And really what happened in Ethiopia was that Italians felt that finally, their nation would expand its empire and catch up with the Joneses, right? And who were the Joneses in this case? It was Britain, with its vast expanses of empire, all of the red on the map. France, with its no less vast swaths of Africa. And even Germany, who had more territory than Italy. So Italians said, finally, we're going to claim what they called our place in the sun. This is the term that they had for Africa. And they teemed with excitement at the Italo-Abyssinian War, and this included Jews. So some Italian Jews volunteered to fight.
They signed up as soldiers or as officers. And others, especially women, again, who couldn't fight, gathered gold and money for the troops. And here's a receipt given to one Jewish lady from Florence who donated four earrings. Four earrings, and then a couple of bracelets, and a couple of chains, and all in all, it was 9 grams of gold and 67 grams of silver, which is, by the way, more jewelry than I own, because jewelry is pretty light. Gold is pretty light. And so what I want to show you now is a couple of testimonies showing Italian Jewish enthusiasm at the war in Ethiopia, about the war in Ethiopia. So these are excerpts from video testimonies carried out by the USC Shoah Foundation, and I should mention that I'm very grateful to them for providing these excerpts for me.
ואספנו ברזל בשביל לתת למולדת ולמדנו בהרבה כל הדברים היפים של פוסולים שלקח לי זמן אחר כך להבין כמה שלא עברנו אבל אז עם כאן ככה
נאומים של מוסולים כמו מה? לדוגמה, את זוכרת איזה נאומים?
אני זוכרת, סבלנו מאתיופיה 40 שנה עכשיו דרים אנחנו עם אחד, עם אחד, לב אחד, רצון אחד. דוצ'ה.
So those are testimonies. So you see, I'm not making it up. And then here's another image, again, illustrating the same kind of idea. This is in 1937, Jewish youth staging patriotic ceremonies to celebrate the first anniversary of victory. If you've ever been to the Florence synagogue, you might recognize the gates over here. They're still around, and these are Jewish youth coming out of the gates in this musical procession to celebrate the victory. And sort of the context behind this is that Jews, by and large, did not oppose Mussolini, and many of them even supported Mussolini. So this was part of their support for Mussolini. And I write a whole lot about that in the book, but I'll also get back to it in passing when I speak about the Jews of Africa and their ideas about fascism. So in their unfailing support for empire, Italian Jews were very similar to non-Jews, right? I mean, most Italians, Jewish or not, supported the empire and felt that it was a chance to put Italy in the spotlight and finally to bring it up to speed with the other powers in Europe. But unlike other Italians, Italian Jews were very different in one respect as far as their ties to the empire. Because Italian Jews considered themselves bound by blood, by religion, and by culture to thousands of indigenous colonized people, and those were the Jews who were native to Africa. How many of these were there? A 1931 census by Italy showed that there were about 21,000 Jews in Tripolitania. Most of them living in Tripoli. A further almost 3,000 Jews in Cyrenaica, most of them living in Benghazi. Almost 200 in Eritrea, and these were mostly traders from Yemen and from Turkey who were living particularly in the coastal area doing their trade. And then approximately a few tens of thousands, perhaps around 50,000 Beta Israel residing in Ethiopia. And they had their own very interesting history. It's slightly inexact to say that they were Jewish just like everyone else, but I can talk about that in the Q&A if there's interest. And by comparison, there were just under 40,000 Jews in the metropole proper, so up there. Now, Italian Jews declared their empathy with these Jews in the colonies, and they saw them as brethren, they expressed concern for their well-being, they fundraised for them, just as they fundraised for impoverished Jews in Eastern Europe, or as they fundraised for Palestine, or they fundraised later for German Jewish refugees, they also fundraised for their downtrodden brethren in Africa, and they kept asking them if they could help. And Jews in the colonies said, yes, actually, you can help. Because Jews in the colonies had various challenges that they were facing. They faced a lot of hostility from the Muslim population in Libya, from the Christian population in Ethiopia, and from the colonial authorities as well. Particularly in Libya, there were periods in the 20s and 30s when the colonial regime was overtly anti-Semitic and had rules, restrictions such as Jews couldn't close their stores on the Sabbath, or they were forced to close them on the Sunday, and those who disobeyed would be flogged. So the Jews in the colonies asked the Jews in the metropole for help, and Jews in the metropole said, yes, we'd like to give it. You are our brothers. But from the beginning, it was Italian Jews made very clear that Jews in the colonies ranked at a slightly lower level. Just by virtue of their being colonized, by virtue of their being African. And one expression of this sense of superiority versus inferiority was that Italian Jews believed that the colonized Jews could not govern themselves. So they needed leaders to be sent from the metropole to the colonies. And particularly this found expression in rabbis. Italian Jews believed that the colonized Jews just couldn't nominate their own rabbis, and indigenous rabbis were not good enough for the task. And so what we get happening is a string of rabbis coming from Italy from the 20s to the late 30s. rabbi after rabbi after rabbi after rabbi coming from the metropole to replace local rabbis in Tripoli. And sometime between the first and second rabbi coming in 1928, the Italian state even passed a law requiring colonized Jewish communities to hire Italian rabbis only. And this was at the bequest of Italian Jews who just thought that indigenous rabbis were not up to the task. Further evidence of this sense of superiority by Italian Jews towards Jews in Africa was the unequal treatment that they gave the latter on their governing bodies. So Italian Jews had a body called the Italian Jewish Congress. It was a meeting of Jewish delegates from all the communities in the peninsula, all the communities under the crown. And they invited Jews from the colonies as well to participate in it. But what's telling is the numbers of delegates. So this document over here shows how many delegates were invited from each town or each Jewish community to participate in the Italian Jewish Congress in 1938, and met every couple of years. And what I want you to notice is, first of all, the colonies are in this sort of separate category, right? It's alphabetical. I'm giving you the second page over here, and the third. And so they're at the end of the list in a separate category. And then take a look at the comparison between Milan and Tripoli. Milan at that time had fewer than 7,000 Jews, and it got 7 delegates. Tripoli had 15,000 Jews, and it got 3 delegates. So Milan had twice the size, half the size of the Jewish community, but had the right to twice as many delegates. And even more stark is the comparison with Addis Ababa, which was permitted only one delegate to represent thousands of Beta Israel. So in this way, the Jews of Italy gave these people a voice, but curtailed it, right? There was a limit to how much of a voice they could have in governance and in talking about the future of the Italian Jewish community. So given these notions of superiority and the way that Italian Jews sort of meddled in the affairs of colonized Jews, Jews in Africa frequently opposed their co-religionists. And to do that, they often invoked colonial law. At times they even appealed to the colonial powers for protection from Italian Jews. So that you get this odd situation where Jews in the empire are at once using or asking Italian Jews for help, for protection from the colonial authorities, and asking the colonial authorities for protection from Italian Jews. I'll give just one example of how Benghazian Jews did this. They invoked the authority of the colonial regime to resist the attempts of Italian Jews in replacing their rabbis. So in 1928, the Rome-based leadership of Italian Jewry gets in touch with Benghazi Jews and says, you know that law where you're required to have an Italian rabbi, a rabbi from the metropole? Well, we found you one. You're welcome. And this, the rabbi that we found is Gustavo Colò, the rabbi of Mantua, and he has kindly agreed to go all the way to Benghazi and to officiate as your rabbi. All you need to do is to pay him a higher salary than what he's currently getting, which was 24,000 lira. Now that was a high salary for the colonies, because the people in the metropole earned more money, particularly white-collar, middle-class Italian Jews earned far more money than in the colonies. And Benghazi Jews reply a very careful letter in which they say, take a close look at Italian colonial law, and clause such and such in paragraph such and such says that we're required to have an Italian rabbi, but it doesn't say anything about who's going to pay him, and we just can't foot the bill. They say, and so Italian, and they say, besides, we've got our own local rabbi called Hamus Fela, and he has been in charge for years, and he's very happy to go on doing the job. And Italian Jews reply icily that absolutely won't do, and the local rabbi cannot stay in place, and there must be an Italian rabbi. But they couldn't very well do anything about it, right? Because they didn't have the funding for that. The Italian Jewish leadership infrastructure was always impoverished, always struggling to make ends meet. And so so they ended up not being able to do anything about it, and the local rabbi stayed in place until he passed away in 1941. So in this case, Benghazi Jews found loopholes in the colonial administration of Libya and used them to preserve what they believed should be the right state of affairs, which is for their local rabbi to stay in office. Now, Jews in Africa, Jews in the colonies then, faced this racism, or faced the notion that they were somehow inferior. They faced it both from the colonial authorities and from Italian Jews. But what I find really interesting is this odd phenomenon that at least some Jews in Italian Africa came to identify as Italians and came to actually very much admire the Italian state. And not only that, but the fascist state, which is exactly what Italy wanted to happen. And oddly enough, the height of this adoration by colonial Jews towards Italy came in the 1920s and 30s under fascism, exactly when the empire was at its most racist. And oddly enough, it happened in Libya, which was exactly where these where the most repressive measures were taking place towards Jews. As I said, in Tripoli, Jews were forbidden from closing their shops on their Sabbath, and if they refused to do that, they were publicly flogged. And add to that, they were prohibited from riding the bus along with any other colonial subject, and various other restrictions simply by virtue of their being colonial subjects. And so that's why I find it so very interesting that some of these Jews in the colonies adopted fascism. And this photograph, in that sense, is telling. If you take a look at this photograph on the left, these are Jewish men in Libya, and they're wearing the fascist uniform. And in this way, they were sort of echoing the same thing that was happening in Italy. Over here on the right is a picture of a Jewish boy making the fascist salute, but I could have also found pictures of adults doing the same thing. And so, as I said, fascism was not something that most Italian Jews were terribly upset about. And so you get that, but perhaps sort of mirroring both in Italy and in the colonies. And I think there's a curious contradiction over here, where fascism has colonized these people, has subjected them to various forms of racism, both anti-Jewish and anti-African, and yet here they are expressing their admiration for fascism. And I'll just give one vivid example of this contradiction, which took place in 1935 on the occasion of the Italian War in Ethiopia. And in December of that year, at the height of the battles, at the height of the sort of war frenzy in Italy, the Jewish women of Benghazi collected an entire kilogram of gold and 2 kilograms of silver. That is a lot of jewelry. And they collected it to donate to the fatherland in its time of need. So they collect all this jewelry, they go from house to house, they get as much jewelry as they can, and they go to the Fascist Federation in Benghazi. And they ask to see the secretary, who's the topmost person there, and they say, look, here's this huge amount of gold and silver for the fatherland. But when they give it to him, the secretary says, I'm so sorry, I can't accept it because you are indigenous. And indigenous people do not have the privilege of collecting gold for the fatherland. So he actually turns down these 3 kilograms of precious metals. Now, Benghazi Jews, apparently unruffled, they don't despair. They write to the Jews in Rome, to the Roman Jewish leadership, and say, look, we've got this huge amount of precious metals which we'd like to donate to the fatherland. Can we do it through you? And the Jews of Rome, which, you know, again, who are more than happy to donate to this cause, say, absolutely, send it. And they take care of it, customs, and make sure that there's no tax to pay. And they receive the metals, and then they take them to the Fascist Federation in Rome, and they submit it in the name of Benghazi. Sabbathean Jews. So I find the irony of this story confounding, because what we have over here is Libyan Jews who are already subject to the inequalities of Italian imperialism, and they're lending their weight to help conquer another colony, only to be rebuffed because of their inferiority as colonial subjects. So it's a very, what I find a very interesting dynamic. And so in that sense, for all its discrimination, the empire had succeeded in persuading at least this group of Jews, and don't exactly know what percentage they were of the population who felt this way, but at least these people succeeded in persuading of its greatness. And the last point I'll make for today, and then we can make way for Q&A, goes back to Italian Jews. And so as I said, Italian Jews supported this racist colonial system. And in a certain way, this same racist system came back to haunt them. Because in late 1938, Italy established a series of race laws. And these race laws said, among other things, that Jews couldn't marry non-Jews, they couldn't work in most professions, they couldn't send their children to school, they couldn't employ Christian babysitters, they couldn't go to the cinema, to the concert hall, to the beach, you name it, it was probably in the list. And these laws, obviously built on German laws, right, sounds familiar, the Nuremberg laws from 1935, but these laws also built on legislation from the colonies, on homebred legislation from the colonies. And these laws use the same languages, the same tropes, the idea of purity of the race, of cleanliness of the race. And I want to end with a couple of images that show how, in the Italian mind, the non-Jewish Italian mind, anti-black sentiment, or anti-African sentiment, and anti-Jewish sentiment ended up being coupled. And so this image over here on the left, which is an iconic image of Italian anti-Semitism, so both images came out in government-sponsored magazines soon after the racial laws. And this image on the left, you can see a sword cutting off two inferior races from what by then Italians called the Italian Aryan race, represented by this noble Roman bust. And the two inferior figures are the African and the Jew, who's represented by the stereotypical nose, which was reminiscent or a remnant of medieval imagery. And in the picture on the right, it's even clearer. Now we get Italy represented by a woman, and note how white she is. This innocent woman who's about to be ravaged by, again, the African and the Jew, who this time is, well, again, represented by the nose and also by some sort of, I suppose, what Italians imagine to be Oriental dress or Orthodox dress. So I'll end there by saying, unwittingly, Italian Jews helped to create the racist atmosphere to which they themselves fell victims. Thank you.
Thank you so much for a wonderful presentation. I will be here to help moderate a Q&A and invite questions. And perhaps I'll take advantage of my position with microphone in hand to lead off with one question. Well, perhaps it's two, of course. How does the situation of Rhodes, especially, which falls under Italian control at the same time as Libya, and holds a population of Jews, how would you say this fits into this story of relationships between metropole and colony, particularly given that Rhodes has a very different racial cultural makeup? And I think my other question, which is related in some abstract sense, is how do the Livornese Jews living in North Africa fit into this equation? Because you spoke about the indigenous Jewish population, by which I assume you mean the Arabophone Jewish population of Libya. But we also have these families, multi-generational families who trace their ancestry to Livorno, but have been within the mercantile community of the Mediterranean in North Africa for some centuries. So I'm curious if you're able to track their place within this matrix. So I'll let you answer, and then we will field some questions from the audience.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I think there's similarities and differences in the case of Rhodes. So Rhodes also becomes effectively an Italian colony. From what I've seen, it looks like the relationship there is slightly less, it's slightly less clear to Italian Jews that they have the right to meddle in the affairs of the Jews of Rhodes, even though they certainly keep tabs on them. They ask them, for instance, for their budgets every year, and the Jews of Rhodes, as the Jews of Benghazi and Tripoli and Massawa and everywhere else, are not thrilled at having to deliver these. But Rhodes had this rabbinical college where Italian Jews wanted to send Italian Jewish students to. So they sort of need something from Rhodes as well. And my sense is that overall, they don't see them in the same way as they see these, what they see as Arab Jews or what they see as Black Jews. Yeah. That's a very good question. And Livornese Jews, I think they act as these sort of mediators. They see themselves as mediators between both the colonizers and Arab-speaking Jews, and between Italian Jews and Arab-speaking Jews, and they see themselves as having a sort of foot on each side. But it seems like they certainly see themselves more as Italians. And as such, they sort of form the elite, and they're eager to set the tone in the colonies. And this is, I think, mostly in Tripoli this happens, and somewhat in Benghazi as well. They're less present in Ethiopia, yeah. But those are very, very two great questions. Food for thought.
Thank you. So if I could show, I see a show of hands, please. Daniel.
Thank you for the great presentation, I learned a lot. I also have two questions, feel free to answer one or both of them matter. I'd be interested to hear about Italian Jewish discourse vis-a-vis the Ethiopian Jewish community. You said 10, what did they, what was their attitude towards them? And what was the attitude of the Italian state, either fascist or pre-fascist, to the fact that then you had this Jewish community in Italy and also these Jewish populations in the colonies? Was there a sense on the part of the state that you had an opportunity to make use of Jews to help facilitate the colonial program? Or was there instead a sort of nervousness about possible risks because of the Jewish community in the colonial in colonial territories? Or do you get both attitudes, or is there no real discussion whatsoever?
Again, these are really terrific questions. I'll do the back to front. The Italian state sees Jews as a tremendous resource, and they want to use Italian Jews to reach out to colonized Jews in order to spread, what's the word I'm looking for, love for Italy, the word escapes me, sorry, philo. Italophilia, yeah. And in fact, what they're nervous about is that other Jews will get there first. And they're particularly nervous about Jews from the Alliance, Jews from France, reaching out to Jews in Libya, but also in Ethiopia, and spreading their influence there as agents of France. So yes, they absolutely see Jews as a resource, and there is correspondence about that, and sort of how can we encourage Italian Jews to speak well of Italy in the ears of colonized Jews, so that we can get a bigger support for our colonizing powers. And so that's a very, very astute question. Ethiopian Jews, they're a very interesting case. So Italian Jews assume that the Beta Israel are Jewish. And I haven't seen much doubt about that in the sources. But in fact, the Beta Israel were different kinds of Jews from the Jews of Libya or Europe or anywhere else. And this is quite a contested subject, so I have to phrase this delicately, but this, the scholarship has shown, and this is by no means my primary field, but there are people like Tudor Parfit, who's an expert on the Beta Israel, and what he's shown is that the Beta Israel weren't always Jews, and that there was this myth circulating around the whole of Africa as to where the 10 lost tribes had ended up. These are the 10 lost tribes who were expelled by Assyria in the 8th century BCE, and nobody really knew where they'd ended up, and they fall off the map because they're not, they disappear from the Bible at a certain point. And so there were these myths held by various groups in Africa as to, we're the 10 lost tribes, we're the 10 lost tribes, we're the 10 lost tribes. And one of these groups who said that were the Vita Israel. And for various reasons, that myth sort of stuck over there, stuck with them, and turned into this sort of acceptance. And then later rabbis would come and find these responsa from the 16th century saying that the 10 lost tribes had ended up in Ethiopia. So that's sort of basically the basis of today's Israel's acceptance today of the Beta Israel as Jews. But when Italian Jews come onto the scene, what's really interesting is some of these Beta Israel turn to the Italian colonizers and say, who are these people and what do they want of us? And we're not the same religion, they say. So it's an interesting inversion of what later happens, which is sort of European Jews casting doubt on the Jewishness of Ethiopian Jews. And at this point in time, the Ethiopian Jews are saying, they're trying to convert us. Right, they see it as a totally different religion, but it's a sort of moment of transition in time, because within a generation or two, the Ethiopian Jews the Beta Israel have picked up, have internalized this discourse, and they say, yes, we are Jewish. Sorry, that was a very long answer, but it was just a very stimulating question.
Thank you very much, very interesting presentation. I also have a host of questions. And it relates to the demographic profile of the colonized Jews. I wonder if you can give a richer sense of the demography of the various communities, and along with that, a sense of what institutional infrastructure pre-existed the Italian colonization effort. Because you say that this halo was imposed on the Jews of Venice, Tripoli. What was there before? What was the rabbinic establishment? What were the rabbinical institutions? What was the educational structure in place? And was there a culture war? Was there a divide within these communities between the more Italianate and the less Italianate? Or was everybody sort of willing to go along? And that leads to the second question. Was there any institution parallel to or evocative of the ILOC that you can use out? Intent on a civilizing mission to bring Italian culture to the colonies and the world beyond. And related to that, what was the legal status of these people? Was there anything parallel to, was there an aspiration toward something like the community of Crete? And finally, in the same period, what's the place of Zionist activity, if any? So answer any one you want.
Next question. No, I'm just kidding. Those are fantastic questions, and I don't know that I have the answer to all of them, but there's so much to say. Let me talk about the Alliance. There was no Italian parallel to the Alliance per se, in the sense of on the scale of the Alliance, but the Italian Jewish community leadership in Italy took on a role of sort of tried to do everything. They reached out to these Jews in the colonies and they tried to set up schools there. And so they, in a way, they were doing everything that the Alliance did, but on a very, 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 very tiny scale. Both because they were underfunded and because they were just overwhelmed by the number of petitions for help that they were getting from colonized Jews. And so what ends up happening is that colonized Jews ask Italian Jews for let's say 100 petitions of help. Italian Jews might end up responding to one. They're just so overwhelmed by everything that's going on. And so they never try, as the Alliance did, to improve there aren't any sort of blanket attempts to improve the legal status of Jews in the colonies. It's never that. It's always trying to turn out the next fire and to handle the next crisis. I don't know that they managed to do much. Yeah, very different in that sense from the Alliance. I feel like I've totally done injustice to your questions, but let me think about them and to be continued.
Thank you so much for this wonderful use of sources that are not explored in the Venice Arch very often, especially not taught in school. So my question is about the relationship between the Catholic culture in Italy and Catholic institutions and the government and Jewish institutions and culture. So in 1929, Mussolini signed the accords with the Vatican, the Lateran Pact. So do you think there is a connection between these institutional accords and the fact that with colonialism, that the regime, fascist regime, was trying to maybe let the Jews migrate to the colonies somehow? So what's the relationship between the Catholic hegemony in Italy and these free racial laws, migration of Jews towards the colonies?
That's another fantastic question.
Repeat it?
Yeah, the question was, did the Lateran Accords or the Lateran Pact of 1929 did it have an effect on Jewish immigration from the metropole to the colonies, if I'm understanding correctly? That's a very interesting question. There wasn't actually a huge immigration of Italian Jews to the colonies, and most of the tensions that are happening over mail, with the exception of these rabbis who go there, and then there were merchants, as Professor Stein mentioned, and there were also Jews who happened to be in the colonial administration, pretty high up even. But there was never a mass migration of, or even any sort of migration of Italian Jews to Africa. That never happens. And I've never come across Italian sources suggesting that should happen. Maybe anti-Semitic fascist officials or any officials who would want to see the Jews leave. It didn't occur to them, I think. But what we do see happening as a result of the Lateran Accords, which is so it's interesting you mentioned that, is happens mostly in the sphere of Italian and Jewish education. And so because in the wake of the Lateran Accords, education becomes much more Catholic in Italy. And so Italian Jews turn inwards and they try to provide more Jewish education. They set up new schools in the wake of those laws. I would have to inquire if it had any spillover effect into the colonies, but thank you for that very, very stimulating question.
So there are a large number of hands, so I'm going to try to move sort of slowly around the room and hopefully we'll catch everybody. Actually, with your indulgence, with everyone's indulgence, what I will ask is I will call on three people at a time, and Professor Klein can gather some questions, and hopefully that way we'll be able to integrate more voices. Jesse. Go ahead and we'll add more.
I wanted to thank you again. This was really interesting, considering also like recent literature that's come out about Libyan Jewish experiences, especially Jen's Hope, who wrote about it in recent edition of a book that we all know about. And I'm like kind of putting your piece in dialogue with his. I'm curious about how you see in your project moving forward, how you're going to deal with relationships of indigenous Jews with indigenous Muslims or indigenous Christians. What kind of archival or source base are you going to work off of? Because I do feel like it seems there's one sentence in your paper that mentions it, and in Jen's work, he argues to a certain extent that Arab nationalism and, you know, know, things happening in Palestine affected indigenous Jewish-Muslim relationships. So I'm just curious if you think that any of that will come out in your future research and support to you. And then just one other question. I thought that this was really interesting if you compare it to Spanish colonialism in Morocco and treatment of Sephardic Jewry in Spanish Morocco. And with that in mind, I'm curious if the Italians set up anything similar to the Spanish in terms of ethnography of Jewish populations in these colonized territories. Spanish version definitely tried to show the very Spanish nature of these Jews, you know, like especially looking at dictionaries of their languages and how it's related to the Spanish language. So I'm just curious if anything was attempted in, especially Libya, in regards to these.
Okay, I can see already that offering three questions at once actually is equal to offering a dozen questions at once. But I think for the sake of integrating voices, I'll call in two more people and Professor Klein can answer as much as she's able or willing from that collection. In the back, please.
Two quick questions. Was there a connection between the Italian Jews and the Jews in the colony as far as business dealings? And how was that to the benefit of the both? Second question, what were the numbers of Jews lost in Italy and in the colonies in the Holocaust, approximately?
And we will add one more before putting our guest on the spot, please.
What was the relationship between the Jews in Italy and fascism? It seems like you may mention that there was some attraction to fascism, some joining in the fascism movement, at least maybe until the racial laws came in. And the second part is, were the Jews threatened in any way when Italy started essentially colonizing what maybe had been perceived to be more inferior Jews? Did that somehow link the Jews in Italy in a different kind of a Jew that may have cast some kind of a shadow on them?
Good luck. Just going to use the restroom. Not kidding. So many questions. I'd really love the reference about Spanish Morocco, if you can talk about that later, because I don't know too much about that. So please share that with me. And then indigenous Muslims, you know, so one thing I'm trying to figure out over here is how much is this going to be a history of Italian Jews and their participation in the empire, and then, in a way, I need to look at colonial Jews, the colonized Jews, only in as much as they're sort of having these points of contact with them, or how much is this a story about both of these communities? And that's something that I still have to figure out. Oh, I say both of these communities, I mean like maybe more like all five or six of these communities, because each of these communities has different history. And that's why I find David's question so scary, because, you know, what sort of like what institutions do they have, it really depends on where and when. But if I am sort of tempted to not leave aside the Jews who are the colonized Jews and to look at them, just because there isn't that much about them, and I feel like I've got these sources and it would be unfair not to talk about them, but there's always this tension between, you know, when you start to think of publication, what are reviewers going to say, and do I have enough Arabic sources in here? But one source that really hasn't been mined is oral histories of Libyan Jews. And there's quite a collection of those in the USC Shell Foundation, there are a few, but in Israel there are lots more, and they just don't seem to have been used. So I was thinking of using that and looking. Then I'd really be able to ask questions about their relationships with Muslim locals. So thank you for that. Well, the Holocaust loss is that's a very easy question. It's so there were almost 8,000 Jews who were sent to Auschwitz from the metropole, and then Italy doesn't start. Well, there are no deportations until September 1943, when the Germans enter Italy,
And then the deportations take place. They're done both by Germans and by Italian police together. The Italian police hunt down Jews, and then the Germans cart them off to Auschwitz. And so several thousand perish that way, and very few return. In the colonies, the Germans actually had a plan to deport the Jews of Libya as well, but they didn't make it because Britain liberated the Libya, parts of Libya in late 42, parts of Libya in early 43. But what they did manage to do, there was a sort of back and forth, particularly in Cyrenaica, went back from the British to the Italians, to the British, the Italians back again. It was sort of ping pong of who held control over it. And during the two times when the Italians had control over it, they deported some of the Jews to Italy, particularly the foreign subjects. And those Jews end up being sent, some of them, to Bergen-Belsen, and we're talking about a few hundreds. So luckily, the thousands and thousands of Jews the 15,000 in Tripoli and the 3,000 in Benghazi, the majority of them never saw the inside of a concentration camp in Europe. Many of them were sent to concentration camps in Libya, but they weren't at risk of being sent to Auschwitz or any of the other killing centers. I feel like I could just go on and on, but should we take another three questions?
Great. I'd like to call on our current Viterbi visiting scholar, Liran Yadgar, who will also, I should note, be giving the third in our Viterbi series talk in January. Am I right? Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you so much for this talk. My interest is actually in the development of Orientalism as a field. You mentioned the Oriental garment of this man in the photos you were charging, quite amazing. So how did the Italian Jews, European Jews study this? Kind of follow-up for the question before. How did Italian Jews, when they encountered the Jews, their burden from Ethiopia or Libya, how did they study those people, their history, especially their languages, like Arabic or Yiddish? Did they develop the study of those languages? This time actually in time. Thank you.
I didn't entirely understand the question.
I think the question is whether there was an ethnography and a body of scholarship.
Ethnographical, historical, linguistic study of those peoples in Libya or in Turkey.
By Italian Jews.
By Italian Jews,
right. And Max, why don't you add a question and we'll turn the microphone over.
I want to ask one small question and one bigger question. One, is there a connection between the Jews of Rhodes and their diaspora in other African colonies? There are a lot of substantial Rhodes Jewish communities that settle in the Belgian Congo and in British Rhodesia. I wonder if there's any connection there about how they kind of got into Africa from Rhodes. And the second question is about the place of Jews in Italy's national memory and history of colonialism and imperialism, if Jews are part of that Italian recollection of their imperial past. And on the Jewish side, in maybe for Italian Jews that are in Israel or in other places, is there a backlash or is there kind of some kind of recrimination of Italian Jews who supported fascism? Mm-hmm.
But what was the first half of the second question?
The place of Jews in Italian national memory of imperialism. So Jews,
okay.
Contemporary Italy.
So like how non-Jews remember this and how Jews remember this?
Yes.
Okay.
Again, let me go back to front because it's fresh in my mind. I would say that Italian Jews today, the way they remember this is, I think the interviews that I showed capture it rather well. I don't know if you noticed, but there's some discomfort for these interviewees in talking about that chapter of their history. Perhaps less so for the girls who were only 9 years old, right? What does a 9-year-old know? But certainly for Mario Pavia, who signed up as a volunteer, and he says it was a stupid thing to do, right? He's a stupid dad, and he says, I shouldn't have done that. And I think today that's That's the way that Italian Jews, I would say a lot of Italians as well, speak about the colonies as something that was sort of that something that is nothing to be proud of, something that is best not talked about too much if possible. That's a sense that I get as far as memory. And as far as Italian Jews who have been, and as far as fascism, and somebody asked about fascism again, I just took too much to refer to, but how do Italian Jews today think about the Italian Jews who have been fascist? That's a very interesting question. I actually have this in the introduction of my book. I think there's a great discomfort with that. And actually, when I went to an archive in Turin, in the book I actually don't say what archive it is, so don't tell anyone. But when I went to the Jewish Archive of Turin, the archivist told me that for every single document I consulted, I had to get his okay. Now that, for those of you who do historical research, that's very unusual, right? I mean, we go through, we sift through hundreds, sometimes thousands of pages, and often we just scan a lot and then look at it later. But every single document I had to get his okay, and I asked him, why is that? And he said, because this or that document might show that this or that Jewish person was a fascist, and we don't very well want their grandchild or great-grandchild having to cope with that, with having that in your book. So I think that there's this discomfort among Jews whose ancestors have been fascist. There's this even book by one person called Ovazza, and he was I think the grandson of Ettore Ovazza, or somehow related to Ettore Ovazza, who was an avid fascist and one of the most famous fascists, and he was a banker. And he wrote a book called It's Not Easy to Have the Name Ovazza. Mm-hmm. And I think that sort of speaks to how, you know, when people meet him, they immediately think, he's the grandson of this Jewish fascist, and how could he have identified with that? Sorry again, I haven't done these questions justice, there's so many of them, but...
I think we have a chance for one more round, and I see three hands, so we will call on all of you, perhaps from front, you first, and then you as the last question, please.
It seems to me that your presentation and most of the discussion of Italian Jews presupposes things that I'm not so sure are true. Recently, there have been studies done genetically of Italian Jews that find something very unique. Jews all over the world genetically have a tremendous amount in common, as do Jews in Italy. But they also find that Italians and Jews genetically have the most in common, which kind of goes against this notion of intermarriage, because the Jews have been in Italy since long before the diaspora. So my question has to do with, we have anti-Semitism with the Holocaust and everything else, and we define diaspora in other countries. How appropriate is that to do with Jews in Italy, who at some point, witnessed by, you know, in Italia si dice non pesce non carne, you're not Jewish, you're not Christian, what are you? Have we just put a stereotype of being diaspora Jews on Italians that might not be as valid in Italy as it is elsewhere in the world?
Thank you.
I'm an Italian Jew and a Holocaust survivor. I was 7 years old in 1935 when Mussolini invaded Ethiopia. I was in the second grade. I went to day school. And indeed, we were taught that what we were doing in Ethiopia was not just colonizing the country, but civilizing the people. And I was a proud young fascist, and so was the rest of my family. My oldest brother was called, in fact, a young fascist, my other brother, an avanguardista, My sister, a young Italian, and I was a little Italian, and we all wore fascist uniforms. And it seemed logical. Mussolini was indeed good to the Jews. There were Jews in high located places. And I grew up under fascism and was quite happy until, of course, the Holocaust occurred. And I'm a survivor due to the fact that a Christian family hit us. And indeed, a lot of Italians, including the little priest and the little nun in convent, despite the Pope, Pius XII, should he never be forgotten, were being hidden by Christian families and convents, because fascism had been not that bad until then, until actually 1938, when the racial laws were passed, and Jews started losing their positions. And I went to day school. It did not affect me, but a lot of children I knew couldn't go to public school anymore. So I see today that anti-Semitism is growing at a disproportionate rate compared to the past. And I wondered, do you think that with continuous integration, because it has integration has also risen in Italy as well as other parts of Europe, that Judaism will somehow someday fade, other than in Israel? And Israel is, they're now contesting the fact that it is a Jewish state. Do you think Judaism will decline?
And we'll have one more question before turning the microphone to Professor Klein for the last time, please.
Thank you so much, grazie tante. This is a question where also sort of reflection. We can only do the best we can with what we got at the moment. And I find extremely difficult to judge today in the 21st century with our way of thinking of the 21st century, whether Jews or not have Jews or quarter Jew or not, with what was happening at the time before the war, Second World War, and before the Holocaust. So my question is, don't you think that at that moment, the Italian Jews, they were not really fascists. They didn't see it as fascists. They saw it as a way of good things for the country, and it would be good for them.
Thank you. Thank you for your questions. Thank you especially for your very relevant personal story. And we invite Professor Klein to respond as you wish to the last questions, but this is also an opportunity for some closing thoughts reflecting on all the questions as a whole.
I'm ready to take you off the bus there.
Thank you so much for that personal testimony. It's always so meaningful when someone in the audience stands up and says, I was part of this story, and it would be an honor for me to interview you if you were ever willing for that. But it was just so special to hear you give that personal sort of vignette of your life, and also so special to see how it all fits in, right? When we talk about these big numbers, but here's a very personal, very, very real life that sort of allows us a window into that. Will Judaism decline? Do you know what I always tell my students? All I know to say for sure is about things that happened in the past, because I'm a historian, and I'm always hesitant to make any statements about the future. But I mean, even for my own research, and Professor Stein mentioned this at the beginning, one of the arguments I make in my book is in Italy, everybody said, and many people still say today, that Judaism was declining. From emancipation, from the 19th century, that was the anxiety of the rabbis, it was the anxiety of Eastern European Jews, that all the Jews in the West were declining. And in fact, one of the arguments I make is that it's change rather than decline, and that even though let's say things like synagogue attendance will decline, but you get new forms of Jewish participation. So I'm rather optimistic in that sense, but yeah, again, that's slightly beyond my expertise to comment on the future. And I think I might leave it at that, just because it's middle of the day and there's still refreshments over there, a bit of grab. And thank you so much. And I really like to get references from a couple of you. Okay, thank you.
Thank you all so much. I want to remind you that tomorrow we gather again at 4 p.m. for Andrew Burns' lecture, The Foundation of the World, The Ecological Ideas of Post-Expulsion Spanish Jews in Italy and the Ottoman Empire. And the flyer is in the back. And I also want to invite you to carry on the conversation about the Holocaust in North Africa with us on November 27th for a book launch of a book by that title, edited by myself and my colleague Omar Boom. Thank you so much, Shira Klein, for your wonderful presentation and your presence, and thank you all for your lively questions and participation.